instructions, and this is work done in collaboration with Song Hee, who is here in the audience, and who is a postdoc here at PI, and Alice Yuan, who is not here in the audience, but who is a graduate student here at PI. Okay. So let's start as we did yesterday with a short review of what we did in lecture two. So given any two permutations of n elements, I gave you a construction of an object that I call M alpha beta, giving us the sum over all possible tree graphs, connected tree graphs, that had the following property. They belong to the set of all tree graphs that are consistent with the alpha permutation, meaning that you can find a planar embedding so that the ordering induced by the planar embedding is alpha. Intersection, all tree graphs that are consistent with the permutation beta. And once you find such a tree graph, what you put here is the product over all internal edges of the tree graph, a quantity that was computed just from the data of where the edge was located, because the edge was separating the graph into two, and PE squared was a function of the Lorentz invariant kinematics variables. So that was what you can call the combinatorial way of computing M alpha beta. And then I gave you another construction from M alpha beta. And this construction was given as a contour integral of this form, where the dependence on the permutations alpha and beta enter in this part, where you had a sequence of poles in the integrand determined by the corresponding permutations. Okay. I also explained yesterday that one of the reasons we spend time studying this object is that we would like to claim, and we have seen evidence, that this part, well, without the integral, this measure seems to be universal. In a way of describing the scattering of massless particles. So far, I haven't given you much evidence because I've used this in order to construct a single scattering amplitude of the simplest possible class of particles, which are scalars. Here, there is a contour. The contour determines the residues that we're computing, and the contour is a union of contours determined by points in CP1 to the n, or points on the moduli space M0, n, that are critical points of a function. So let me put here. These are the critical points of the function s defined in this way. Okay. Now, something we didn't get time to discuss yesterday was that the reason this is well defined as a contour integral or even as a differential form on the moduli space of endpoints on the Riemann surface, of marked points on the Riemann surface, is the following. Under a Möbius transformation that takes sigma to A sigma plus B and C sigma plus D, it's easy to check that the measure transforms as follows. Okay. Now let me give a name to this part so that I don't have to write it again. I'm going to call this the integrand on the left. And not very surprisingly, I'm going to call this the right integrand. Now you can easily see that under the same transformation, both the integral on the left and the integral on the right transform as follows. So the differential form is a well-defined differential form on the moduli space. Okay. Yes, that's right. Yes. So let's pick one of the particular contours, right? One of these. So let's write it explicitly. Sorry. So choose a critical point. Okay. And then the contour is given as follows. Is defined as a collection of S1s given by solving these equations near the solution that you're interested in. So what's the topology of this contour? It's S1 to the n minus 3. It's a real cycle indeed, but the reason is that we're doing a purely holomorphic integral, so we're doing a contour integral over a real cycle. The complex dimension of our manifold is n minus 3. So we needed a real cycle for doing the calculation. Yes?
So you said yesterday that the measure is going to be same for all the massless theories, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and you said that the integrands are then different. And so do they transform? Does it require just like that in all the other theories?
Exactly. So this is a requirement. So that's the purpose. So you found the hidden purpose of introducing this notation, I left and I right. Meaning that for any theory that we have, this must be true. Okay? And speaking of more interesting theories, let's move on to Young-Mills. And we're going to consider a UN gauge group. And what we're going to be scattering are called gluons. So another purpose for starting with this bi-adjoint scalar theory was that life was almost maximally complicated in that case. In that case, we had two flavor groups. And here, we just have one gauge group. So that means that the scattering amplitude, which I'm not going to tell you exactly what it depends on, but it has some color structure. So we can also perform exactly the same color decomposition we did for the bi-adjoint scalar, but this time we need a single trace factor, not two as we had for the bi-adjoint scalar. So we're also interested in the coefficients that appear here, and these are exactly the coefficients if you go down to four dimensions and you introduce four supercharges or four amounts of supersymmetry. These are the quantities that Mark Spratling was talking about yesterday. These quantities, as Spratling mentioned, they depend on the ordering, just as our M alpha betas did, but they now depend on a single ordering, the ordering alpha. But also somebody asked yesterday, well, scalars are very boring because they don't have any further structure. They only depend on their momentum. Well, to make life more interesting, let's consider gluons. Gluons are particles that carry a polarization vector this time. So this is Colin Physics polarization vector. And in four dimensions, this is what Spratling was referring to as saying that gluons only carry two different polarizations. In more dimensions, they can carry more polarizations. They have more degrees of freedom in more dimensions. But something that is true is that the number of degrees of freedom is less than the number of degrees of freedom in a vector. So that's what I was saying by saying that we're using the round representation to describe these particles. So we have to impose two constraints. One of them is the transversality constraint. And the second one is that we're only interested in equivalence classes of these polarization vectors. In other words, whatever we compute must give us the same answer if you choose a different polarization vector related to the original one by a transformation of this one. As you can see, this is going to be a very, very strong constraint. It's not very easy to write functions that satisfy this constraint. In fact, Feynman diagrams become very complicated precisely because they are trying very hard to make this property valid. So, just as we did for the scalar theory, the object that appears multiplying the trace is something that now doesn't depend on the color structure. In that case, it was the flavor structure. And this object only depends on what we call the kinematic data. Okay. So the claim is that there is a formula for this object A. Let me consider the canonical ordering. And write for you the ansatz for what this amplitude should be. Not difficult to guess, because what I told you was that this object was going to be universal. Now we need something that carries information of the ordering. We said that this particular object has a planar ordering, and the ordering is 1 through n. Well, it's also not difficult to guess that if you're missing, you have only one permutation and you don't have the other one, you could just borrow this part and hope for the best for the second part. So the object we have to find now is an object or a right integrand for Young-Mills theory. This object, unlike the previous case, is something that not only depends on K, on the momentum vectors, but it would also have to depend on the polarization vectors, and of course, on the puncture locations, sigma a. What do we know about that object? The first observation is that, of course, it has to satisfy the property like that we have there. It has to have the proper PSL2C transformation. What else do we know? It must be multilinear in the polarization vectors. This is a physical constraint, but it just comes from the fact that the polarization vectors are the wave functions of the particles you are scattering, and you have one per particle. And this is something that you attach to the particle when the particle is going to be scattered. And therefore, it's something that if you multiply or you rescale by a factor, the whole scattering amplitude should rescale by the same factor. So the whole scattering amplitude must be multilinear in these objects. In other words, it must contain exactly one and only one such factor. The next constraint is that it must be invariant under gauge transformations. So the way I'm going to impose gauge transformation is that this right integrand has to be zero if we choose any of the polarization vectors to be identical to one of the momentum vectors. So if I give you one more hint, probably you will be able to guess it. Well, the hint is that it must be a function of only the Lorentz invariant combinations Yes. So you might be thinking that in this case it's different from the abelian case because, well, we have a non-abelian gauge group and so on. Gauge transformations are more complicated and so on. But that's just a misunderstanding. The reason is that gauge invariance has nothing to do with the gauge group, really. It's just the fact that you're choosing the wrong representation to describe a particle. So from the point of view of representation theory, a gluon or a photon, no matter what you're doing, must be described by a massless representation of the Poincaré algebra. A vector representation of the Lorentz group is a wrong representation. So you just have to fix that, okay? And this is the way to do it. All the color structure, the non-abelian structure, is already in the traces, okay? Of course, when you want to describe fields, when you want to describe your theory as a quantum field theory, all these different structures get tangled up. And that's what you remember. You say, well, a gauge transformation is something more complicated. Yes, indeed. This is starting without fields at all. This is starting with particles as the fundamental objects. Yes. Okay, so the last hint is that whatever makes this work has to be as simple as possible. Well, as simple as possible means that I would like to make this identity, this object, or this property as manifest as possible, which means that it should become a property of linear algebra. And since these are the only objects that I can use, of course, I can also use sigmas and differences of sigmas, because I need the proper transformation under SL2C. Then You're motivated to look for a matrix. This is going to be a 2m by 2m matrix that has the following property. First of all, it's going to be anti-symmetric. So it has zeros in the diagonal. The next property it has is that the entries in this block are of the form ka.kb, sigma a, sigma b. These are the entries in this whole block. The entries in this block are of the form, the same structure but with polarization vectors. Now the ones here are of the form and I have to tell you what happens in the diagonals. And the ones here would be of the form now let me give a name to these matrices, to these blocks. I'm going to call the first block A, the second block B, this one C, and C transpose. And the diagonals of C, or C, is a matrix whose rows add up to zero. And that defines the elements in the diagonal. Okay? Now, why this structure and where does it come from? Well, this is something that can be motivated from string theory, and indeed, in the lectures tomorrow that Lionel Mason will start giving, you will see how this emerges from a conformal field theory. So right now, I'm not motivating it more than what I just did with the properties. I'll just show that it has the properties that you need. Well, of course, I still haven't told you how to construct this. I'm just giving you the definition of this matrix. But let's consider a few of its properties so that you see how we can construct this object. So, let's carefully consider the first column. So the first column of the matrix has the following structure. An dot k1, sigma n minus sigma 1. These are the first n elements. And the rest, I'll tell you what this is in a second, but here you will have k2 dot epsilon 1, sigma 2, sigma 1, up to kn dot epsilon 1, sigma m minus sigma 1. So this is the first one. I'm not writing anything else until I get to the m plus 1 column, which I've denoted as 1 again. And you will see why. Here again, I'm not telling you what this element is, but I'm going to tell you what this is. It's k3 dot epsilon 1, sigma 3 minus sigma 1, all the way to kn dot epsilon 1, sigma n minus sigma 1. And here I get 0, epsilon 2, epsilon 1, sigma 2 minus sigma 1. And I keep going up to epsilon n, epsilon 1, sigma n, minus sigma 1. And I'm hoping somebody would say, well, but this matrix doesn't look like the matrix you have up there. Especially this part doesn't look like what I declared to be that part, right? So here, this matrix is a matrix that has, this matrix has this matrix has epsilon 2 dot k1 all the way to epsilon n dot k1. And this entry is going to be minus the sum of these entries. So let me give you these entries first. This is minus the sum of these entries. I said all the rows in C will have to add up to 0. So in particular, this column has to add up to 0. So that defines this element. And this element is given by this. Okay? And this is the rest of the matrix. The matrix is anti-symmetric, so this object over there has to be minus this object. So I can write it here, kb dot epsilon 1 over sigma b minus epsilon 1 from b 2 to n. Okay? So the reason I went through the trouble of writing this carefully, even at the risk of making a mistake, is the following. I want to impose gauge invariant in the simplest possible way. So let me consider what happens to this matrix when I replace epsilon 1, the polarization vector 1, by its momentum vector. Now let me find some color chalk. So if we do that, the first thing we note is that here, this becomes k1, 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 and so on. And this is k1. Now you see that this, well, if I had written it correctly, I missed the second one. This becomes identical to this. They are identical. These two become identical when I make the substitution, and so on. They all become identical, except for these ones. This is supposed to be zero if I want them to be identical. But have you ever seen this combination? Is this something we have seen? Well, we didn't review it, but if you remember, the form of EA, so maybe we should write it here, EA was sum over SAB over sigma A minus sigma B for B from 1 to N and B different from A. So if you set A equals 1, meaning E1, and you make the substitution we said yesterday, the identification of the matrix S with the inner products of these vectors, we get exactly what we have over there. And we are evaluating everything. We're going to be computing residues. So we are evaluating everything on the contours where the EAs vanish. And therefore, on each one of the critical points of our real function, or each of the contours, this is identically zero. And now we have discovered that gauge invariance becomes the statement that this matrix has an increased core rank when you make the evaluation or when you make the substitution of epsilon of one of the polarization vectors by one of these vectors. So that means that you need an object, given a matrix, you need an object that vanishes every time its core rank increases. Well, The first thing that comes to your mind, of course, is the Pfaffian of that matrix, because it's anti-symmetric. If it had been a symmetric matrix, you would have thought about the determinant. But given that it's anti-symmetric, I'm sure you all thought about the Pfaffian. So the claim is that we can take the right integrand to be the Pfaffian of these matrix. Now, the determinant wouldn't have worked, and the reason is that the determinant would have been of degree 2 in each of the polarization vectors. So the determinant of psi would have been, is of degree 2, has degree 2, in each, yeah. But the Pfaffian is the square root of the determinant, so the Pfaffian is, or the Pfaffian has, is multilinear in the absence. So this object is great. It's multilinear in the epsilons. You can check that it transforms correctly. It does this in the most natural way. It depends on this. But in fact, it's slightly too simple. So it satisfies this, but too much. Because this object happens to be zero. So we have to fix that problem. And the reason this object is zero, and you will see in the lectures in the rest of the week with Mason, is that our nice redundancy group, or our nice symmetry group, is actually extended to a supergroup, PSL2/1, and that means that there is a fermionic redundancy. And it would take a long time to explain how to write it in such a way that this is manifest and so on, but what it turns out is that there is a way of defining an object by gauge fixing this redundancy. And the object is defined as follows. You realize that the matrix psi has core rank 2, and you remove 2 rows and 2 columns from the first set, of n labels, and you divide by the difference of the sigmas. And this object is independent of the choice I and j. So it deserves to be called the pseudo-Pfaffian of this matrix. And that's the correct choice. So in Young-Mills, this object is the Pfaffian prime of the matrix psi that I give you there. Okay.
So there's one element where you come out of the fact that there's some kind of homogeneity property. When you guys get sigma like the square and three by linear, then it's homogeneous. So you use that. It's particular ratio.
Well, that is what you get by imposing that it has a correct dimensionality. Okay, so you want every element of this then to have the same mass dimension. Of course, the polarization vectors are massless, they're dimensionless. But then, in order to have the correct mass dimension, you know that they have to be arranged in this form.
I'm asking about, I'm looking at the KK, the ratio of KK over sigma.
Yes. Oh, why that ratio? Well, there is a good intuition, which I didn't want to say, but maybe I'll just say it. The reason I didn't want to say it is that I avoided at all costs going defining the compactification of the modal space. But if you include the whole modal space, and you also allow yourself to explore regions where the punctures can collide, or the mark points can be on top of each other, You know, those regions must match the places in the kinematic space where you have, well, I answered that question yesterday, where you can create on-shell particles. And those are places where the sum of the KABs can vanish. Okay? In particular, you can have two particles becoming what is called collinear, and that means that the Ka.kb vanishes. Okay? Now, you see that Ka.kb is precisely together with the singularity sigma a minus sigma b. You would say, but isn't that crazy? Didn't you say that you want a singularity when Ka.kb is equal to zero? That's true. I want a singularity, but that singularity is already provided by the measure. So having extra singularities will give us poles in the amplitude which are not physical, so I have to cancel them. Okay? Or likewise, if I have extra factors of Ka or Kb in the numerator, they will provide extra zeros that the amplitude doesn't have. So I have to find a balance, and that balance is provided precisely by these combinations. So these combinations tell you that you cannot have too many zeros or too many poles. Yes. So in order to make this Pfaffian well defined, you remove two rows and two columns of the first set. So two rows from here and two columns from here. Say the ith and the j. Now the resulting matrix is non-singular, and it has a well-defined Pfaffian.
Is this Pfaffian related to this Poisson structure that was talking about yesterday?
Well, I don't know. It would be interesting to know. In fact, so these points, you can think about this moduli space as conf n in P1. So perhaps even these sigmas or these cross ratios, you can think of them as cluster variables of a cluster algebra. So it would be interesting to know what this Pfaffian, how the Pfaffian behaves. Okay. Well, R is just on the right, and L is on the left.
Oh, you just split it
up. Yes. Oh. But now that's a good question. That brings us to gravity. So note that this factor that we had and this factor, they had the same transformation properties under PSL2. And that means that basically we could have exchanged them. So in fact, we found a meaningful amplitude, the biscalar, by using two of these factors, right? So the biscalar theory that we started with had two of these factors. Young-Mills has one factor of this and one factor of this. So what do you think gravity is going to be? So maybe I should have written I left here and I right. And it started by saying that when you have two factors of this form, this is the bi-adjoint scalar. When you have one factor of this and this object, you get Young-Mills. Well, now it's just natural to try and replace both factors by two copies of this, and that gives you gravity. Okay? So in principle, we could stop the lectures here, but I told you I wasn't going to prove how many solutions are there in the, how many critical points a function has, but I gave you a number. I told you that the number was n minus 3 factorial. So I still don't intend to prove it. Instead, I'll find all n minus 3 factorial solutions for you. But for a special choice of kinematic variables, which is still generic in the sense that we're not sitting at any boundary of the moduli space. And what I'm going to show you was realized by Calosius in 1312-77-43. So what he did is actually fairly simple, but it requires having in your mind several things at the same time, which are not usually there. So you fix the first three mark points at these values, and the reason you do it will become clear in a second. But it's just so that your brain can make the correct connection. So let me write this explicitly. So written in this form, and if you're an expert in orthogonal polynomials, you will immediately recognize this and say, well, if I choose some special values of this, something is going to happen. But if you're not an expert in orthogonal polynomials, you will have to go through all the books and find something that is related to this, and you will find that Jacobi polynomials do the job. So the Jacobi polynomials are the solutions to a second-order differential equation, which I'm not going to write down. But let me just say that they depend on two parameters. Oh, it's unfortunate. They are called alpha and beta. Well, you know, these are just real parameters. Moreover, if both of them are greater or equal than minus 1, or greater than minus 1, then these polynomials, let me call it here b, some constant, they have m distinct roots. Okay? And you can show that these roots satisfy the following property. And this equation looks strikingly similar to this equation. If we only made the following substitution, if we identify every SAB with A and B greater or equal than 4, if we declare that they were 1, and SA1, we declare it to be 1 plus beta half. And SA2, we declare it to be 1 plus alpha over 2. And the rest are determined by the conditions that we discussed yesterday. And we identify n, or m, with m minus 3, then the equations we have to solve become identical to the equations that the roots of the Jacobi polynomials satisfy. And that means that any map that sends the m minus 3 values of sigma to the roots to the n minus 3 roots of the Jacobi polynomials are solutions or are critical points of the function S. So any map would do. Or any such identification will do. And how many identifications are there? Well, and we find explicitly n minus 3 factorial solutions. Is this clear? So it's quite remarkable that this was actually possible. And as I said, this choice of kinematic invariants is special in the sense that it's a particular one, but it actually falls in the region of being generic. OK, so in the last 10 minutes, I want to discuss how to go down to 4 dimensions which is where we started. Okay. And in order to do that, let me give you another way of realizing. Generic, I mean that no combination of them will produce on-shell particles.
But what I mean is, what happens to alpha and beta? If it's an
alpha, oh, alpha and beta,
or the
they only, they are, this is a two-parameter family.
Yeah. So you get a two-parameter family.
Yeah, well, no, not me. I mean, he gave a two-parameter family of solutions. No? You choose different alphas and betas, you get different kinematic invariants, but you find the answer. So it's quite remarkable. Satisfying that condition. If you violate the condition, you hit singularities. That's still an open problem. Why this differential equation enters and why is this related to these solutions?
I don't know. Equation?
Well, no, the differential equation, that's part of the relation, that the differential equation is related to some problem of some Hamiltonian of points on the sphere. Yes. Yes, indeed. Okay. So in order to do this, let me introduce, this is going to be a meromorphic. There are many words here. It's a Lorentz vector of meromorphic one forms on CP1. So this is a Lorentz index. This is your one form. And this is why it's meromorphic. Okay. Now, instead of using the real function that I introduced yesterday and finding its critical points, you can say the following. S has a critical point, or a critical point, you can replace this statement by the following statement, if and only if the following quadratic differential is identically zero. So this is another way of imposing the same or deriving the same constraints. You start with this meromorphic differential, or this Lorentz vector of meromorphic differentials, and you construct this scalar quadratic differential. In fact, I could write it like this. And you impose that it's identically zero. Now, instead of starting with the form of the quadratic differential, I want to start all over again. Now, with a generic quadratic, with a generic meromorphic differential that only has poles at the marked points. And when I do that, I start with something that has this form. And I don't care where the zeros are located. All I need is that this object only has poles here. So I have to, or I'm allowed to put a vector of polynomials as long as the degree of the vectors of the polynomials is n minus 2. I don't have a pole at infinity. And then a set of conditions equivalent to those conditions over there are the following. We just have to impose that the residues of this meromorphic one form agree with the momentum vectors and that this polynomial is identically zero. That would be the equivalent of the vanishing of the quadratic differential. And now we're going to see why four dimensions is special. So set your dimensionality to be 4. It means that we're working in R1, 3. And let's write this equation explicitly. So we have the zeroth component. Remember, in physics, we like to denote the components of a vector as 0, 1, 2, and 3, just to remember that 0 is special. So we have P0. Square minus p1 square, p2 square, p3 square is equal to 0. I'm going to rewrite this in a trivial form. Okay? As an identity or a condition between two polynomials of degree 2 times n minus 2. But this polynomial factors nicely as a polynomial of the form p0 minus p3 and p0 plus p3. This one also factors. Where this I is square root of minus 1. Okay. Now, what do we have? We have an identity between sets of polynomials. Okay. This is a polynomial of degree n minus 2, as well as this one, and as well as this one. Now, any root of this polynomial has to be a root of this polynomial, right? But this polynomial factors into 2. So any root of this guy either is a root of this polynomial or a root of this polynomial. So it splits into 2. Okay? So let me collect all the roots of this polynomial, which are also roots of this polynomial. And I'm going to call them a polynomial lambda. In fact, I'm going to give it a label, lambda 1. The names are going to be very strange and unmotivated at this point, but I'll tell you later why I'm choosing to call the names in that, the polynomials in that way. So this is some polynomial made out of all the roots, or that contains all the roots of this that are also shared by this. The remaining roots must be roots of this polynomial. I warned you that that the names are going to be completely strange and unmotivated. But you probably didn't expect that strange and that unmotivated. Even a dot in on top of the one and a tilde. And that is a root of this polynomial. I'm going to do exactly the same with this one. Okay, and then I'm basically done. Because from this observation, it's clear that the polynomial equations split into branches. And the branches are determined by the degree or the choice of degree of just the first polynomial. What are the possible degrees of this polynomial? Well, clearly, it can have degree 0. I mean, I can choose it to contain no roots whatsoever, 1. Or it could contain all possible roots. Now, it turns out that these two are inconsistent with this condition. I'm not going to tell you why, but they are inconsistent with that condition. So we have to throw them away. So the possible degrees that I'm going to call D are 1, 2, all the way to n minus 3. Now we have found that the solutions are split into sectors. And only happens in 4 dimensions. Have you heard something like that? Well, you did yesterday. In Spratlin's talk, he introduced a quantity called k. And k take values from 2 to n minus 2. And therefore, d is related to k minus 1. So amplitudes naturally split into sectors labeled by k. So as it was discussed yesterday, we have the number of particles, the sector k, and the loop level, which so far we have been setting to 0, but I'm sure Mark is going to fix that problem. Okay. So just by realizing that we're in 4 dimensions, we have discovered the splitting into these sectors. And those sectors are called the helicity sectors. But how do the n minus 3 factorial solutions split into sectors? Remember, solving these polynomial equations is equivalent to solving the problem of finding the critical points of the function s. And I told you there were n minus 3 factorial solutions. And the question is, I just told you that these solutions will split into sectors according to k. And I want to know what the sectors are. Let me quickly remind you of a combinatorial object called the Eulerian numbers. These are numbers that satisfy the following recursion relation. And the sum over all of them, if you fix the upper one, happens to be p factorial. Well, it turns out that these n minus 3 factorial solutions split exactly in this form. Okay. Now, there is something interesting, and is that if you have ever seen the table of these Eulerian numbers, is that the Eulerian numbers which have this quantity 0 are all equal to 1. And whenever this number differs from this number by just one unit, they are also equal to 1. So that means that in four dimensions, there are very, very special sectors. There are sectors where our polynomial equations will not be horrendous polynomial equations. They will just be linear. And they will have a single solution. What are these sectors? So the k equals 2 and the k equals m minus 2 are very, very simple sectors, and they are called maximally helicity violating sectors, or MHP. And you will probably see people talking about MHP next to MHP. And what they refer to is a classification of sectors, starting with the simplest possible ones. And it's precisely these MHP amplitudes that were computed by Park and Taylor in the 80s. I told you at the beginning of the lectures that Park and Taylor did a heroic calculation, and they were able to compute a sector of all possible amplitudes. And what amplitudes they computed were exactly these amplitudes, which are the ones sitting in the simplest possible sector. And these amplitudes that precisely correspond to polynomials of degree 1 are the ones that Nair realize as correlation functions on CP1. And the CP1, which he thought was naturally sitting inside CP3, which was the twisted space of Minkowski space defined by Penrose. But he couldn't generalize it for any other sector. And it was when Witten came along and said, well, what you're missing is that these lambda 1z and lambda 2z are really the homogeneous coordinates of a CP1, but not living all by itself, but living in CP3. And what you're missing, to generalize this to the whole story, is that the maps from the CP1 that you have here into CP3, you must allow it to have any degree. And the degrees are related to the sectors in this way. And that's how twister string theory was born, by realizing that the CP1 that Nair had discovered was not sitting in CP3, was really the worldsheet of a string. And you had to classify the sectors by the possible embeddings of this CP1 into CP3. And those embeddings are classified by the degree of the map. Okay? And this So in the lectures that will follow tomorrow and after that, Lionel Mason will explain not only how this comes along, but also a worldsheet theory that gives rise to the other formulas that I explained today in any number of dimensions. But now they will not be based on twister space. it will be based on another construction called ambitwister space. Okay? But you will have to wait until tomorrow. Thank you. Why are they called like that?
Yeah.
I need 2 minutes to answer that question. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
I mean, I first have to ask for permission. Yeah, so the reason they are called like that is the following. As I said that in four dimensions, well, Spratling also mentioned, particles come with two possible polarizations. Let's denote the polarizations by a sign, plus or minus, okay? So if you have some process where you have particles of a given helicity coming in and particles of a given helicity coming out, you would call this process helicity conserving. You have three pluses and three minuses coming out, so this would be something that preserves helicity. Now, if you have something where you flip, you have two positive helicity coming in, and you have negative helicities coming out, you would call that something that violates helicity. In fact, helicity is not a quantity that is a conserved quantity in nature. So the number of helicity plus and the number of helicity minus don't have to agree with each other. Now, you could also imagine that you have one plus and everything else coming out to be minus. And this would be a way of violating helicity maximally, right? You only have one plus and everything coming out minus. But it turns out that these amplitudes vanish, okay? These amplitudes are identically zero. So the best you can do is to have two pluses and any number of minuses coming out, and those amplitudes are the first ones that are non-zero, and they are called the ones that violate helicity maximally. And guess what these two is? These two. So you can increase the number of pluses here, and this number will keep increasing.
So you have to do this contour integral over all the zeros of S, and those should be explained how those zeros break up into sectors, and those k's are then corresponding.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Any other comments or questions? So you've been doing trig level.
Yes.
So you've been talking about M0 and.
Exactly, yes. That will probably happen on Friday, or maybe Saturday. Not that far. There will be a story for M1 comma n. Not for MG comma n, but for M1 comma n. Unless I'm surprised. Unless I'm up for a surprise, which could be. Yes, it's very interesting that even the bosonic ones, even the scalar one, the calculation splits into sectors in four dimensions. But separating them is artificial. So what you do is you sum over all the sectors to get your answer. In gauge theory, separating them is meaningful. So you can talk about each one of them as its own object.